Beginning in the ministry, I served our congregation in Knoxville, Tennessee, where I was ordained. A congregation that was formed in 1949 is the only racially integrated congregation in its region, any denomination. And so I was particularly honored when an African-American colleague invited me to come preach at his church. Never preached in a black church before, and I arrived with my carefully prepared manuscript sermon, only to hear my colleague say, "What's that?" And when I explained it was my sermon for the morning, he snorted, "If you can't remember your message, how do you expect them to?" A memory which served me well when I ran for the presidency of our association, where I knew I was always in danger of having a microphone stuck in front of my face asking, "What do Unitarian Universalists think about fill in the blank?" What my message is today has a great deal to do with forming friendships that get us out of our comfort zone, that transcend those things that often characterize our relative privilege, whether it be a privilege of social class, or race, or gender, or sexual orientation, and to form bonds with people that share, yes, some vision of the future, some ideals, but who may be very different from ourselves. Like this congregation, the one that I belong to in San Francisco, in which I served for a while, belongs to a network called Faith in Action Bay Area. And this summer, I've participated in one of their new programs called Belong, where my new spiritual friend is named Maria Luisa, a woman who came here 30 years ago fleeing the violence of her native El Salvador to raise her children and to feel safe. She still doesn't. She has no documents. To know her situation and to feel her faith and persistence and integrity, well, all I can tell you is that it helps me maintain mine. For this was the great insight of our transcendentalist forebears. If I am going to fulfill my potential as a spiritual and moral being, I have to be concerned about you fulfilling yours. That fulfillment transcends us both. If our job is to become the full moral, spiritual agents we were put on this earth to be, then I have to be concerned, well, like Bronson Alcott was with those kids, really drawing out their full potential, not by fear, but by encouragement. But what inspires me most about the transcendentalists is not the ones who were out in Concord with Alcott and Thoreau and Emerson. They were probably the individualistic wing of the movement. But Sarah's right, I told her. Most transcendentalists were activists based in their churches, mostly in the cities. And they formed friendships that made a difference across lines of gender and race, and really sparked the American struggle for women's rights and racial justice and so much more in the way of social reform. They had a method that involved deep personal self-examination. They wrote journals, they wrote letters. Oh my God, did they write I've been deciphering their handwriting for years now. They would share their journals with one another. A remarkable exercise. So that the voice that they were dialoguing with internally would be shared with somebody that they trusted, who encouraged them to really pay attention to what needed attention and to let aside the rest. We need friends like that. One great example is a Unitarian minister at the time that was, he was probably the youngest member of the Transcendentalist Circle when it first formed in 1836. His name is James Freeman Clark. When I was president, I had his portrait hanging above my desk at UUA headquarters. Boy, I admired this fellow. He wrote 22 books. He became the first professor of comparative religion in the United States. But he started at the age of 20, studying the German idealists with his friend Margaret Fuller. I actually found his handwritten journal, which is like a verbatim from CPE. That is, trying to convey the actual dialogue that he had with Margaret. It goes on for 20 pages. J, I hesitate to come to you when I have no fresh ideas to share. M, what makes you think I'm interested in your ideas? Or more or less. And if that sounds slightly flirtatious, believe me, it was. They were both 20. But they figured out soon enough that Margaret was not the kind of woman who was going to be a 19th century minister's wife. I sometimes think Jamie, as she called him, fled all the way to Louisville, Kentucky, which was then the frontier, becoming the first Unitarian minister west of the Appalachians. Partly because he didn't know quite how to maintain this relationship with Margaret, except in writing. And when he confessed to her that he was having a terrible time trying to preach extempore, as they expected him to do on the frontier, she wrote him encouragement and sermon ideas that would be easier to speak about this way. And he published her first essays in a journal he started called The Western Messenger, until she found the courage to become the hub of a network of women in conversation with the ancient myths of the Greeks and Romans, whom the guys got to learn about in college, but the women didn't, and to see some of the built-in sexism. This was a transformative moment in American women's rights. One of the late participants in the group was a woman named Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Well, Clark also had a friend named Theodore Parker, who I think of as the epitome of the Unitarian ministers of that age, who embodied courage and social prophecy. He believed before the American Civil War that we were going to need to go through a second American Revolution in order to rid ourselves of the original sin of slavery. No one agreed with him more than his friend and fellow abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who, after the US Supreme Court came down with the dreadful decision in the case of Dred Scott that African Americans could not appeal to the courts and had no hope of becoming US citizens without a change in the Constitution, Douglass wrote a poem in which he used the term conflagration to refer to what would be necessary to purge our nation of its racism. I took that as the title of the book. Pardon me if the proud papa shows another baby. Bound Galleys came out on Friday. know how many of you ever saw a remarkable movie called Boyhood by the filmmaker Richard Linklater. Uses the same young actor from age 7 to 19. So it took 12 years to make. Well, this book only took 7. But Linklater, when he was profiled in The New Yorker, said that he'd always wanted to make a film about the Transcendentalists. Because when his father took him to the Unitarian Church in Houston, Texas, when he was a boy himself, he learned that they'd changed America in the direction of women's rights and anti-racism. But he said, I can't figure out how to make such a film without too many scenes of people in period costumes sitting in parlors having high-minded discussions. And that's no movie. Well, the best thing that happened to me this week is that one of the early reviewers of the book has recommended it to Linklater as the basis of a TV series. Why do we need to reinterpret the Transcendentalists? Because they are at the core of our spiritual heritage as Unitarian Universalists. And by the way, that form of faith that is not tied to creed that I share with Maria Luisa and with Cornel West and even back with Theodore Parker and Frederick Douglass. Parker famously said that absolute religion, or that which transcends traditions, consists of nothing more than loving the ground of our being, however we name it or don't name it, with all of our heart, mind, and soul, and then loving our neighbors as ourselves. That's it. All else, as Hillel would have put it in his commentary, he also is the source of two of the most widely requoted phrases in the American civic tradition. Government of the people, by the people, for the people. Picked up by Abraham Lincoln, whose law partner read Parker's sermons. But that's a Unitarian minister. The moral arc of the universe bends toward justice. It's law, but it bends toward justice. Dr. King picked that up from a grandchild of Parker's congregation who used it in a publication of the NAACP. But it's Parker. Now, one of the more remarkable things that I discovered this winter when I was completing my research for this book had to do with Parker, who, like many of the people of his time, suffered from a chronic illness. He had tuberculosis, consumption, as they called it. And in a vain attempt to lessen the symptoms, he'd gone first to the Caribbean and then to the Mediterranean. He ended up dying in Florence in May of 1860. He was probably lucky that he didn't have to be on this side of the pond. He was one of the secret six, all of them, either Transcendentalists or influenced by them, who had backed the radical white abolitionist John Brown. And he stood in danger of being accused of treason. Well, I didn't know this until I visited his grave in Florence. And the keeper of the cemetery said, you know who paid for that monument, don't you? Frederick Douglass. This has not been published even in the recent award-winning biography of Douglass. 27 years to the day after Parker died in Florence, Frederick Douglass, then the most famous African-American in the world, went out of his way to take the night train from Rome to Florence to arrive on May the 10th and go directly, as he put it, after coffee, to the grave of Parker, and then write to his friend, Theodore Stanton, Elizabeth Cady Stanton's son. You're right. Parker's marker is inadequate. A man like that should have a monument that is a sermon in itself. And he then commissioned the best known sculptor in Rome to put up the monument that you'll see when this story is told in the UU World magazine this fall, with a bas-relief of Parker in his last year. A greater citation about his accomplishments as a preacher. And then the remarkable phrase, "His name is here inscribed in marble. His virtues on the hearts of those whom he saved from slavery and superstition." Now, for me, the fact that this African American felt so powerfully toward this white liberal minister is just the tip of the iceberg of what I feel was core to the transcendentalist method again. Yes, some deep personal reflection, some going inward, but always in partnership with those different from oneself who could bring out the best and help sustain the struggle to realize those transcendent ideals that are only partly present in this room, in this time, but whose fulfillment lies beyond that horizon over which none of us can see, but toward which we need to be pointed in constant hope and faith and love if those ideals are to be made real for our children and our children's children, for those who will follow us in this life. For we are all just a small part of the world. We desperately need one another's spiritual sustenance to become the people that we were meant to be and to make this world what it was meant to be. I could go on with historical examples. That cabin that Thoreau went to, I found that on one August day, when African Americans in the 1840s celebrated the fact that the British had emancipated the slaves in the Caribbean colonies, like Jamaica, an escaped slave named Lewis Hayden stood on the steps of Thoreau's cabin and told his story to a gathering that included Emerson and the members of the Concord Anti-Slavery Society. Wasn't a great speech. Hayden was no Frederick Douglass. He hadn't been given the privileges of real literacy while still enslaved. He'd been owned, by the way, by Henry Clay, the sometime senator from Kentucky, the great compromiser who lay behind the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850. You know that was the price for getting California into the Union as a free state. Parker had stood at a rally against the Fugitive Slave Law and addressed his fellow citizens of Boston as citizens of Virginia because they were being required to cast out, to send back people who had come to them for protection and safety, to escape slavery and to assert their human rights. Does any of this sound vaguely relevant and familiar? The struggle goes on, my friends. It transcends us all. It behooves us all to do our small part. And maybe the way to do that is friend by friend, day by day, step by courageous step, coming back here where we are safe and where the building abounds in love, to build an example of community that will transcend the realities of our tragic and still fallible nation, and help make it what it should be in our troubled and fragile world. At least, so let us pray. So let us make service and friendship the very form of that longing of the heart, which is our shared prayer. Amen.